I'm Craig Ravensloat. I'm a researcher at the Research and Training Center on Disability in Rural Communities at the University of Montana, also with the Rural Institute on Disabilities. And I want to talk today about a study that we did funded by NIDER in our Research and Training Center on Disability in Rural Communities. I have no relationships to disclose, at least not germane to this presentation. I want to acknowledge our staff and consumer advisors, Dr. Mark's presentation. We do participatory research, and we had advisors from a number of different CILs across the country, including Blue Water in Port Huron, Michigan, Wyoming Services for Independent Living in Lander, Access Alaska in Fairbanks, Brazoria County Center for Independent Living in Huntsville, Texas, and then we also along the way picked up Suzanne Carpenter, a doctor, a primary care physician in Huntsville, and Jan McGinty, an RN. And so they helped guide the development of the intervention that I'm going to be talking about. The purpose of the study was to begin to examine one of the problems that we see in rural America, and kind of the way that it crosses up with what we tend to see in health management, and that is that a lot of self-management, it's essential for health maintenance, especially for people in rural areas where they live in fairly resource-poor environments, and that health behavior change interventions have relied heavily on individual level change, where we're teaching people how to change particular kinds of behaviors and depending on them to maintain those changes over time. An emerging strategy out of managed care organizations has been self-management support, and that's been kind of a top-down process where managed care organizations train their primary care providers, nurses, and physicians to help people and support them in their health behavior change efforts. So asking them about their goals around diet and nutrition and things like that, and asking them what they need to begin to address that. But in this work, it seemed as though we would probably not see self-management support come to rural America for some time. So we thought, let's look at that from a different direction. Let's see if we can do that from the bottom up. So we developed and evaluated a self-management support intervention for rural people with disabilities, and we hypothesized that this intervention would lead to better maintenance of treatment effects when compared to a control condition. So our research sites were eight different centers for independent living that were, again, across the country, mostly in rural areas or serving rural areas, and included Cedar Rapids, Edison, New Jersey, Denville, New Jersey, Troy, New York, Jackson, Mississippi, Waterloo, Iowa, Osage City, Kansas, and Yuma, Arizona. We did lose one study in Kansas, one study site, because they lost funding. And I also noted on here that three of our sites were in the direct path of Hurricane Sandy between the post-test and the follow-up. So we had finished our intervention, but when we went to look at our follow-up data, we actually pushed our data collection out by a little bit because Hurricane Sandy came through. So in looking at follow-up, we actually have some kind of interesting effects to talk about. So the participants in the study, our control condition had 30 folks and our treatment 28, so 58 total. They are on average about 50 years old, predominantly female. Typically we see about 60%. Our control group was a little higher than that. By way of race, 33% and 20% were Black Americans. Caucasians made up 60 and 75%. Income was similar to what we see out of these Centers for Independent Living, about $10,000 to $15,000 annually, and around 30% were wheelchair users. So we didn't see any substantial differences in the demographics between our treatment and control groups. I should also mention, just going back, that the research sites were randomly assigned with respect to whether or not they had implemented our Living Well with a Disability program. So we put out a call for research partners to April, the Association of Programs for Rural Independent Living, and we drew about half of these sites were people who had already implemented our Living Well program. So we stratified on that basis so that we didn't end up with an unbalanced number of folks who had done health promotion training that we had supported. We didn't want them to be dialed into how to do training and have that be one of the effects that led to the difference between treatment and control. So we did stratify around that. So the intervention condition that we put together was done in four sessions, generally on a weekly basis, that followed this self-management support idea. And it was implemented one-on-one with consumers and Independent Living Center IL staff. And the first session we titled On Your Mark, and it followed a similar approach to goal setting that we've done with our Living Well with a Disability program, where we get people to consider the link between their quality of life goals and what they're doing with their health management. But then in order to get them to think about goals, we implemented using desktop computers that were at the CIL so that people could search images and think about quality of life goals through images. And for some people, that was better than words. So that was something that we were looking at. And in the second session, we had a get ready self-assessment, and that was getting folks to think about what they were ready to pursue with regard to health behavior, secondary conditions, and then also their independent living needs. And so by completing the self-assessment, we would give them immediate real-time results that would help them to prioritize what they might want to address as they got into the intervention. Once they had an idea of what their needs might be with regard to either health behaviors or independent living, then the third session that we called Get Set was personal community resource mapping. And we used Google My Maps for this, where people could search for resources in their community or in their region. So if, for example, you had a dietary need that you identified, you might search Google Maps for somebody who does nutrition training, and you might find that there's somebody in your town at the local hospital, or you might find that it's regionally available and that you have to travel a little bit. But with Google My Maps and that kind of technology, people could see what was available for them on a regional basis. So once they had that in hand, then the last part introduced a day planner. We've found over the years that not very many people that we work with use a day planner to help organize what they're doing. So we introduced a day planner that allowed them to track what they had identified from their self-assessment, and we provided some self-advocacy training so that as they were going out looking for supports, they would have some specific ideas about how to request those supports and advocate for those. And so, in fact, that's really the self-management support, is getting people to look out into their community to identify the resources that are there, and then to have the self-advocacy skills to go ask for what they need. And so this might have included primary care. It might have included personal trainers, fitness centers. There's a lot of different things that people could have looked at through this process. So then we collected measures, and we collected them pre-post and 3 months post. Oh, I should also go back. Sorry. Our control condition in this was the last three sessions of our Living Well with a Disability program, which are physical activity, nutrition, and maintenance. And we put those in a similar format in four sessions that our control condition worked through one-to-one. And basically, it was health information and some behavior change topics to help people implement those kinds of ideas around physical activity and nutrition. So that in terms of measures, we collected the Health Promoting Lifestyle Profile 2. For secondary conditions, we used our surveillance instrument on secondary conditions. And then we adapted a couple of measures from David Gray's work in participation and barriers. And he's been doing some nice work with some adaptive computerized testing. But we didn't have that luxury for working in rural CIL, so we adapted these to a paper and pencil measure. So we basically had a brief measure of barriers that people rated they encountered. And then we looked at the number of trips they made into community and also looked at engagements like regular religious activities or employment or volunteering. I'm going to be presenting just on trips into the community today because that's where we found the sensitivity in this. The measures were all collected immediately pre-post and then 3 months post, again pushing a little bit out past the hurricane since we had the centers there. And so I'm going to present these results today pictorially for you. I've got graphs of the outcomes and they are listed by the pre-post and follow-up measures. And then the first one we're looking at is the Health Promoting Lifestyle 2. And so the blue line is the control condition, green line is our treatment condition. And if you look at the escalation of these from pre to post, which is over the intervention period, both groups changed. So we see a within-subject effect that's statistically significant, but it is not related to the treatment condition. So whether or not they got the materials from our Living Well program or the new materials didn't make any difference there. And then this next line is the follow-up condition. And so for our treatment folks, our hypothesis was that we would see better change at follow-up, and we did. And the idea is that if people got supports from the community and self-management support, that then once the program was over, they would still have those supports in place. and that if you do an educational program and you end the program, then you depend on their maintenance and knowledge gained in order to continue with whatever health behavior that is. So in the health behavior profile 2, that plays out, and I should probably end my presentation here, because as you know, in these small kind of pilot studies where we've got 30 people in each condition, things can get a little wonky after that. So let's go on. So this is that measure of secondary conditions. People rate the severity of their secondary conditions, and then we sum across those, and I think we had around 30 conditions in this. And it's everything from psychosocial conditions like depression to things like chronic pain and urinary tract infections. And so here again, we see a big decrease in each group in those secondary conditions. These groups started a little higher than what we've seen in some of our previous research, and then they dropped significantly. Again, it's a within subjects significant treatment effect, but we don't see any group differences. And this time, the reason I should have stopped is because this next elevation suggests that at the follow-up period, both groups pretty much returned to baseline. I don't think our control condition reached that, but there's no significant difference in secondary conditions at the follow-up period, and overall, these groups have returned to baseline on secondary conditions. But keep in mind that I mentioned a little bit ago that the hurricane that blew through the area, and it's actually the reason I wanted to do this presentation, because sometimes you get those little serendipitous things that happen in research and you go, oh, that's a bummer, that makes it hard to interpret, but we'll get there in a minute. So I said we looked at barriers, and we thought, well, if people are looking to their community resources for self-management support, maybe they will be participating more, maybe they will have fewer barriers, they'll address some of those kinds of things. And so again, both groups show some decline. That this is not a significant decline in the control group. In the treatment group, it is. The treatment group then maintains this over time at the follow-up, but the control group somehow gets it going, and they end up at almost exactly the same place. Both groups end up reporting from at least the pretests, pretty substantial reductions in the barriers that they encounter for community participation. So perhaps they're solving some of those issues. And again, they're rating things like difficulties with physical access and problems with the climate and noise and a whole slew of different kinds of things. And then for trips to the community, and then we hope to see that if they're engaging more in community, they're going out more. And this is just, these are the higher base rate kinds of trips that people make into community that we ask them during the past week, how many times did you go to the grocery store, to the pharmacy, to the big box store, to the different places? It's a proxy for just getting out, if you will. And so we see, again, a nice change in that people are, in fact, going out more. Part of this might have to do with the intervention itself, because they're coming to the CIL to do the intervention. So we know that, you know, from 11 to 13, maybe one of those trips is to do the intervention itself. So that's maybe not too impressive. But equally less impressive is that both groups then return to baseline at follow-up. So in terms of an effect on trips into the community, it seemed to happen only during the intervention period, perhaps related to that in some way. So now Hurricane Sandy. So we had two of our control conditions and one of our treatment conditions were in the path of the hurricane. And we see that if we look at the group on the left here, these are the folks that were in groups not affected by Hurricane Sandy. And this is very similar to the effect that we saw before when we were looking at just the straight-up conditions around the health-promoting lifestyle, where the control condition is returning to baseline, treatment condition is maintaining over time. These are for the folks that are not affected, and here's the folks that were affected. So again, the control group looks the same, and we see at least maintenance, if not a little more escalation in the treatment group. And this could be just simply a treatment group effect. However, at the very least, I think it suggests that for people who are looking out to their community for resources prior to Hurricane Sandy hitting, there may have been some protective effect in that. And that kind of makes sense if you start to think that through a little bit, that if I have been trained up to look to my community for what I need and I find myself in a natural disaster, perhaps that's helpful for me when that occurs, because now I'm ready to look out to my community. So I think that there might be something in that, and it's the reason I wanted to do the talk today, to just put that in the backs of your minds in terms of both health promotion and disaster preparedness. If people are ready to look for assistance, maybe that's helpful. And then This now comes out in looking at secondary conditions, where we see return to baseline basically for both of the groups that weren't affected by Hurricane Sandy. For this one that was, they're at least maintaining with their secondary conditions. So whatever gains they made over the treatment condition before Sandy blew in, they maintain that over time. We don't see that with the control condition. So wrapping up, maybe these brief one-on-one interventions can affect self-reported health outcomes when delivered by Center for Independent Living staff. That longer-term outcomes may be better when people learn about resources in their community for making health behavior change. And that learning to use community resources may also have protective effects following disaster. These are small groups, pilot kinds of results, but I do like when a research project raises some interesting questions about what might be useful for folks. So thank you very much.